Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Hey y'all, and welcome to Touchy Subjects Podcast, the podcast that aims to break the silence that tends to come with conversations around domestic and sexual violence. I'm Sean.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we are doing our part two of our consent culture conversation with our special guest, Kitty Stryker. So thanks for joining us again today, Kitty.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the last time you were here, which was probably our last episode, if I do all of our editing correctly, we kind of ended saying that we were going to have a deeper dive and like a deeper discussion. And when we had met prior to recording, you had mentioned that you can usually have two kinds of discussions when it comes to consent culture. So this is going to be the one where we're going to dive a little bit deeper into that conversation.
So, yeah. I think I said something along the lines of like, when you first start talking about consent culture, there's sort of that consent 101 conversation you need to have first. But, yeah, honestly, most consent culture related stuff is that gray area in between the black and white. And I think that that doesn't always get as much attention as it should.
Yeah. And kind of speaking a little bit to that gray area, that the gray area, at least that we typically talk about as educators doing talking about like consent to like high school kids, is usually when it comes to around like alcohol specifically, just like that gray area of, well, legally you cannot consent once you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol. But if, like, for example, my partner and I go out for like two drinks and then we go home and have sex, like, did we break the law? I mean, from the way it's written, technically, but we both still knew what we were agreeing to in that moment. So there's a little bit of gray area typically in discussions around consent to begin with, but I have a feeling, Kitty, with the gray areas that we're going to be discussing today aren't the ones that we typically discuss.
Yeah, I mean, even within the legality of being under the influence to consent to sex, we see in court cases that that isn't seen as a reason you can't give consent, even though the law is very clear on the topic. So there's sort of what the law says and then how the law is enacted, yeah, which causes its own gray area of like, okay, well, how drunk is too drunk? How under the influence is too under the influence? Are we counting weed? You know, living in California, pot is, well, it's as legal as it can be without it being federally legal. So, you know, like how much weed ends up being too much. And usually when I'm talking to people, I'm like, if I don't feel safe to drive, then I don't feel safe to ascertain my ability to consent. But I mean, drugs and alcohol are just one area of potential blurriness and uncertainty. There's also, you know, if this is your long-term partner and you depend on them for your housing, you might feel a little less comfortable saying no. And there's a subtle coercion there that's not necessarily coming directly from your partner, but just coming from an environmental situation that I think is important to think about. And I mean, impossible to legislate.
Yeah. And we had mentioned kind of that like subtler coercion conversation a little bit last time. I think we also, when we met too, we talked about kind of like manipulation and how manipulation in of itself gets like a bad rap as a term, but we can do good, quote unquote, good forms of manipulation, like buying my fiance a video game because I know she's going to play it, but that also gives me the opportunity to play video games. So I manipulated her into playing video games that gives me the opportunity to do that too. But it's when we're looking at that like subtle coercion, it's, yeah, it's there, but is there really anything, or what kind of conversations can you have then with your partner to really make sure or kind of help alleviate some of that if you are feeling like that could be present?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that I try to remember is that you aren't going to be capable of anticipating every possible way that something can go wrong, or that someone could feel coerced, or someone might say later, that's not really what I wanted to do, actually. I don't think it's possible to anticipate that for someone else. I can't anticipate that for myself. So how on earth can I expect somebody else to anticipate that for me? That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, right? Like, just because you can't get to 100% doesn't mean that it's not worth making an effort. So that, I like to think of it that way, in part because it's the foundation of that is you will mess up. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you did something wrong, or that you're bad, or that your partner did something wrong, or that they're bad, or that your communication is bad, or there's something wrong with your relationship, or somebody was abusing somebody else. It just means that sometimes things go wrong, or like sometimes miscommunications happen. Sometimes, you know, I can consent to something and I'm not enthusiastic, but that doesn't make my consent any less. And I mean, that's definitely informed from my history having been a sex worker. But I like to point out to people that it's not something that's just about sex work, that enthusiastic consent is something we demand from sex workers. But nobody cared about my enthusiastic consent when I was folding t-shirts at Hot Topic, you know, like, so there's like this weird demand that consent be super clear, super enthusiastic all of the time. And even that is a subtle form of societal coercion, you know, like this idea that you have to be on all the time is in itself a form of coercion.
So looking at the enthusiastic consent piece, it's interesting because you're right. Even on like an everyday kind of thing where, for example, like let's say my fiance has a food that she really, really enjoys eating and it's something I hate. But if I cook that for her for dinner because I know this will make her happy, I'm still consenting to eat that meal. I'm not going to be happy about it. It's not going to be something I really want to eat right now. But because of the way that we do educate on consent, when you say like, yeah, it has to be enthusiastic consent every single time, sometimes you're doing stuff because maybe you aren't super pumped about doing it, but you know that this is something that is going to be, that your partner is going to enjoy, your partner's going to want to do it, which also I'm not saying like in terms of like a sexual encounter, like you should just be giving in to your partner because you know they're going to want to do it and you don't want to. But from like that general like societal level consent that we're talking about, yeah, it's going to happen regularly.
Right. I mean, you know, I realized into my mid-30s that I was asexual, and that a lot of the reason why I liked sex work was because being asexual enabled me to focus on sort of the academia of sex and how that worked. So it wasn't something that I was sexually excited about, but I was intellectually excited. So there's even subtleties like that where like my body's like, eh, I guess I'm in it for the ride, whatever. Like, but my brain is like, ooh, this is a data point and I'm very interested in that. So let's do that. But I also, I had sex in relationships. I wasn't seeking it out, but I wasn't disgusted by it. It didn't cause me trauma. It's just like, given a list of things to do, it was probably not in my top five, but I wasn't like upset about it either. So I think this idea of having to be enthusiastic, I feel like that also gets projected at women a lot. And I just keep feeling like there are so many ways in which women's relationship to sexuality is constantly problematized, often by white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. Like, I think there was a blog I read when I was starting to figure out consent culture and what I wanted that to mean. And the blog was called Rad Trans Femme RADTRANSFEM. And it was this trans woman who was writing from a mostly second wave feminist perspective in a way I found really interesting, because I feel like those viewpoints are often so opposed, right? But I think that she helped me find things in that framework that I really appreciated and really helped me gain more understanding of the ways that consent and coercion work in our society. And one of the things that she did that I really appreciated was talked about how there's this idea that you have sex positive feminism that says that sex is pleasurable and great and wonderful. And then you have sex negative feminism, which says, well, sex can be really traumatic and forced and demanded. And there, you know, that's come to mean like, oh, well, you want to be sex positive, so that means that you should say yes to sex all the time, because otherwise you're sex negative, right? And if you're sex negative, it's like, oh, you're just sex negative because you're a prude. When actually, I think it's a little more complicated than that. There's the idea of, I live in the Bay Area, so San Francisco. There's this idea that sex positivity means sex is compulsory, as like, well, sex is something that is pleasurable and good for you, and therefore you should want it. You should want to have lots of relationships. And if you don't, then that's because you aren't as evolved, you know, or like there's something wrong with you. And that's not the attitude. I mean, that's not sex positivity. That's not what sex positivity, as coined by Carol Queen, I believe, that's not what that was supposed to mean. So I feel a lot of empathy, because it's like, yeah, that's how I feel about consent culture too, is that it came to mean something very different from what it actually was meant to mean. And then on the other side, I mean, there was a period of time I identified as a sex negative pornographer, because I liked taking that sex negative framework and using that to interpret the kind of porn that I made, and using that framework of how do I create something that indicates, I don't know, like that sex isn't the be all end all. And can you do that in porn? I don't know. Like, you know, it's just really interesting to think about. And so it's like taking these ideas, like trying to take away coercion, trying to take away the influence of patriarchy and see what's left over while still acknowledging that you can't get rid of it 100%. So yeah, sorry, that's a long ramble to say that I think that the idea of sex positivity has been tainted by a society that likes to use sex to sell things. And I think that I've seen sex positivity used to push people into having more sex than they want, because otherwise they're boring, or, you know, they're not, what was it? GGG, good giving in game, right? Like, and I don't think you should have to be, you know, like, I think it's okay to not be that into sex. It's okay to have other interests. It's also okay to be super into sex and want to have it all the time. You know, that was my 20s. And now I can understand, like, oh, I was gathering data. Okay, that makes sense. You know, I think it can be complex. And even though my intentions in having sex in my 20s were not to seek out pleasure per se, though that happened along the way, I'm happy to report, but like that wasn't my goal. I didn't have that context in my 20s. And I don't regret it now that I'm in my 30s, even if I now understand myself more and understand the environment that I'm in more, to be like, oh yeah, some of those situations probably weren't the best for me, or probably I wasn't able to see what I was being influenced by, or like why I was doing this, or why I stayed in that situation when I didn't really want to. Now I can have a better understanding for myself and sort of a forgiveness for myself of like, okay, yeah, like I live in an area where people go to sex parties as a way to meet new people. Like, you know, like, so of course I'm going to be in an environment where that's the norm, mm-hmm. and that's going to change my perspective. That yeah. doesn't mean that there's something wrong with them or that there's something wrong with me. Just that, like, as I gain understanding, that nuance begins to come into play. I think that nuance makes people really uncomfortable because it's super scary. It's scary to realize that you could do something that you are super into today and a year from now be like, oh, that was a bad idea. And I really wish I hadn't done that. It's really scary for your partner who doesn't want to be a rapist. You know, like, I don't think that that's necessarily rape, but there are people who do consider that rape always, you know? And I think it's like, I think it can be more complicated. We can sometimes have sex that we aren't super excited about and maybe regret without it necessarily being a sexual assault. I think that, again, that's very, very difficult to create a legal framework around. But I mean, also, our legal frameworks aren't working. Yeah. So clearly, that's not the be-all, end-all of those definitions. It's just, it's all very messy and complicated.
Well, right. Anybody who's been in a long-term relationship with somebody knows that the two of you aren't always going to want to have sex at the same time. And it's not that, it's not something that you are, you know, you're like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. It's just like, eh, I just don't really feel like it right now. I'm just not really into it. But you really are. So, you know, to make you happy, like, I want to do it to make you happy, even if I'm not really into it right now. And I think that's one of those things that a lot of people are kind of looking at right now and going like, well, if I'm not really into it, you know, is it non-consensual? But you do those things sometimes when you're in a long-term relationship. It's just the way that, you know, life kind of works. And it doesn't mean that you're violating each other in any way. It's just, you know, this, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and I think it's really telling to me how we have that understanding when it comes to all of the other shit that we have to do all the time, but not when it comes to sexuality. You know, like, we understand that, okay, I'm not super excited to go to the gym today, but I'm gonna do that because that's a commitment that I made, or like, there's some other reason I want the end result. Like, that was one of the things I realized. Sometimes I had sex not because I wanted the sex, but because I wanted the end result of the intimacy, or I wanted the end result of a really cool porn film, or I wanted the end result of, you know, a fun story later, you know, like, sometimes that was, and that was good enough for me. That was a good enough reason for me. Yeah, I think, but like, when it comes to something like work, you know, we understand that we're not always super excited to go to work. We go to work anyway because we want the end result of getting paid, you know, mm-hmm. and that's okay in that context. We're not like, oh no, like, I mean, I guess there are some people on Twitter and Tumblr who would say like, see, this is it. We're all work is coercion. And I mean, there is some truth to that, mm-hmm. right? So like, how do you decide how much coercion is okay? I don't think that's something anyone else could decide for us. I don't think that's something you can create mm-hmm. a law around. I think that's just something you got to figure out how much you're yeah. willing to tolerate, you know? Yeah,
that feels like a very kind of personal like line that you would draw for yourself. But Kitty, I also want to bring up, because you mentioned it in there and I want to kind of see how this conversation would go. So you said you were fine with the end results of what it would be if you were to have the sexual encounter and you got the end result of what you wanted. So I'm wondering how that conversation would play out, though, because one of the forms when we talk about, when we're talking about human trafficking, one of the forms that we talk about for sex trafficking is somebody who wants that end result. It's like, I don't have a place to live right now, but I can stay on this person's couch if I have sex with them. So they're getting the end result of having a place, having a shelter over their head, but that person is very actively manipulating them to see, they saw a vulnerable person to be able to take advantage of. And yeah, that victim may have been quote unquote fine with the end result because they got a place to stay. But the person who was sexually trafficking them did so because they were vulnerable and took advantage of them. So where is that? Where is that line of, are you okay with the end result?
I don't know.
When it's that is considered human trafficking.
I mean, and I think that you see that a lot when with teens too, is that like, you can't always fully understand the implications of the end result. You know, like, I mean, I think I could say that now because I've spent like, you know, 13 years thinking extremely deeply about consent culture. So like, I can't, and I also have a lot of freedom. I have a lot of agency. So if I decide that I don't like the end result anymore, I don't have to do it anymore. And I think in a situation like trafficking or an abusive relationship, your freedom to say no is limited or non-existent. One of the phrases I like to use is, if I can't say no, then my yes doesn't mean anything. And that is a way that I often assess for myself, like, do I want to do this? Like, do I feel like I can say no safely? And when I say I don't think I can say no safely, what is the level of risk here? Because like, sometimes I'm like, I can't say no to going to, I don't know, grandma's birthday party. I don't want to go. The food's going to be awful, you know, like, and I don't want to listen to a bunch of like elderly folks talk about their gout. Not my favorite afternoon activity. But, you know, I feel like I can say no. I also feel like there's a lot of social pressure for me not to say no. So, but the consequences are grandma's disappointed. That sucks and that's hurtful. But I mean, I'm not unsafe, you know, like grandma's not going to come and shoot me for not showing up. So like, yeah, I think that there's so, people want it to be so simple and so easy. And I think it's like this amorphous ball of consent rather than it being even a spectrum. That's just a line. I think it's like, there's so many different aspects that come into play. And I think that that makes it really difficult when people want to learn about consent and like are like, okay, I want to know the formula that will enable me to never have my consent violated and never have me violate anyone else's consent. And it is emotionally devastating to realize that that formula doesn't exist and can't exist. Yeah. That there are so many aspects that come into play, including things like structural oppression that limits your ability to consent or limits how much agency you feel that you have and how much agency you feel that you have versus how much agency you actually have, which is also a complex situation. You might have more agency than you realize, but because of past trauma, because of systematic oppression, you might not feel as capable of enacting that, you know? And so like, that doesn't make it less real just because it's something that is an internal struggle for you. Yeah, there's a reason why when I started doing consent culture work, it seriously broke me for like a year or two. It was really emotionally difficult because I had to come to terms with not only the times that my consent was violated in ways that I didn't consider traumatic, but they were still violations of consent, but also the times that I had violated someone else's consent. And maybe they didn't make a big deal out of it, but I realized how unsure I was that they were there because they wanted to be there. And so that's really difficult to like sit with that and to own that and to sort of break away from your own ego there and be like, okay, so if that's the case, if I don't believe that anyone can 100% consent ever under a white supremacist capitalist patriarchy because of these influences that are on us, whether or not we recognize them, then I have to be okay with the fact that sometimes my boundaries are going to be crossed. I might not always realize it in the moment and be able to do something about it in the moment. It doesn't mean that they're evil. So I can't just be mad at them, you know, as a way of making myself feel better. But also, I'm going to do that to others. And, you know, sometimes people are going to tell me that I, you know, damaged their consent or I violated them in some way. And they're not going to be nice about it. And I have to be willing to sit with that and be like, okay, you know, like I, this is something for me to learn from. I don't remember if I said this in our pre-conversation or in the last episode, but like, I think there is something really powerful in recognizing that when someone calls you out or like tells you, hey, you violated my consent. Hey, you stepped on my foot. Even if they're saying it in a really mean way, they are saying it to you because they trust that on some level you want to do better. And that them giving you this information is something you will take on board. If they didn't believe that you are capable of change, I don't think they would tell you that. They wouldn't bother. They would just talk shit about you behind your back, you know? Like, so it's, there is a positive, even when it stings, you know, and it's like by recognizing that positive, it's a little bit easier to take a step back and be like, okay, how do I take this in without being defensive?
Yeah. Being a human like is always going to be a learning thing for us. Like we're always going to be learning. If you're never learning anything, you're not ever growing and staying stagnant is boring. But just the human experience is you're always going to come to eventually a point where you're like, ooh, I did something I don't like. Let me change that about myself. Let me fix that. Let me make sure I don't violate that person's consent in that way again. And not all of the violations are going to be super bad ones. Not every violation of consent is going to be you sexually assaulting someone else. Right. You're violating someone's consent could simply be like, I cooked dinner for my fiance and I made it too spicy knowing she doesn't like spicy foods. That's a boundary she has set. I violated it by making it too spicy.
And I think we did talk about like maybe violation is like kind of an intense word for some of these things. But like, I think it's like when you start to take a step back and look at it from a wider perspective, you begin to say, oh, okay. Why did I make it that spicy? Mm-hmm. Like, what was it? Was I not paying attention? Was that what happened? Like, did I reach for the wrong thing and then go, oops, well, that's done now.
You know? See what happens. See if she
like,
notices.
Yeah. Was it a way of testing to be like, ooh, I wonder if she'll notice, you know? And like, understanding why you did that will help you not do it again. But it also gives you information about yourself. And, you know, not that other people should pay the price for you learning about yourself.
Right.
But like, I think that it's possible to try not to hurt other people and also learn from the times that we fucked up, you know, or like we just made a mistake. I have a tattoo that says evolve or die. So I take that concept very seriously because, you know, I mean, call me a science nerd, but I think it's one of the things I find so interesting about our misunderstanding of Darwin, right? This whole idea of survival of the fittest. They didn't mean fittest by the strongest.
Yeah.
They meant fittest as the most adaptable. And so by being adaptable, by being able to recognize when things are shifting and changing and being able to adjust yourself, that is what makes you the fittest. I think that is something Americans are very like, what? That sounds like some sappy, vulnerable bullshit, you know? But like, that is what survival of the fittest actually is about. It's not about being the strongest and the toughest and the most rigid. It's the absolute opposite of that. And I think that, I don't know, I guess that informs a lot of my frameworks, is like figuring out ways that you can do as little damage to others as possible while still evolving and educating yourself and learning and making new mistakes instead of the same old ones over and over again.
Right. If you can't look back at your history and things that you've done in your life and go, ooh, that was not good of me to do, then you're not growing as a person. Because, you know, I mean, just what's been culturally acceptable in the 90s, words or phrases that we used, we didn't really think anything of it. And now I'm like, oh gosh, I should not have said that. It doesn't mean that I should forever be held accountable to today's standard of what the standard was then. Was it acceptable? Was it good to use that term even then? No, absolutely not. But now, in a more evolved state that I'm in now, I can look back and I can be like, yeah, that was inappropriate. And I definitely shouldn't have done that. And then, like you said, I have to sit and I have to resonate with that and say, what can I do better now?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, it's like you don't know what you don't know. Right? Like, yeah. You don't know what hurts people if they don't tell you that it hurts them. And I think that's especially true for language. I mean, as somebody who vocally identifies as queer, just throughout my life, since I started identifying that way at 14 to now, it was a slur, and then it was a source of pride, and now it's a slur again, maybe? I don't know. Like, and I still identify with it, and I'm still sticking with it. I have my reasons for that. But, you know, I'm also willing to have that conversation with somebody. If they're like, it really hurts me when I hear that word, I could say, I understand. And these are the reasons why I choose to reclaim it. But also, I recognize that you don't have to do that. And it's okay for it to be hurtful for you. You know, like, it's okay for it to have both of those things. Now, I think when it comes to things for other people, like, we don't get to decide that for other people. We can only really decide these things for ourselves and what we're comfortable calling ourselves. But, you know, I think there are... Oh, well, I did say this was going to be the spicy one. So I'm going to go there because it's almost pride season. So we're going to have this debate again, I'm sure, whether or not kinky people should be at pride. I am somebody who has been going to pride since I was pretty young, and leather people have always been at pride. And I believe very strongly that they absolutely belong there. They created a lot of pride. And I think that it is erasing history and dishonoring the you know, the wealth of labor and energy the leather community put in to gay communities to try to kick them out, because some people now believe that it's too much. It's too gay, it's too sexual, it's too perverse, and it shouldn't be at Pride. That is an area of consent culture that I disagree with certain other groups about, you know? And like, there are people who have tried to tell me that, like, well, we shouldn't have leather people at Pride because, you know, asexuals find it upsetting. And as an asexual, I'm like, don't speak for me. You know, like, I don't find it upsetting because I don't register it. Like, I don't, but I don't have like disgust around sexuality. So like, that's me. But there are situations like this, like whether or not leather people should be allowed at Pride, like whether or not drag queens should be allowed at Pride. I've heard that conversation before, that they're too flamboyant, they're too dramatic, and that it's hurting Pride for the rest of us. I am absolutely against that. I think that that's messed up, and I think that that is trying to rewrite history. And I think that if you don't like that at Pride, don't go to Pride.
What I find just kind of interesting about this is how it almost feels like this happens every single time with different, like, different kinds of events or things that are pushing towards societal changes. It's like when you look at the women's movement, is who was starting the women's movement? Like, a lot of that had to deal with trans women were involved in that. But then as they were progressing very early, they're like, if we include trans women, we might not get the steps that we want to make. So they excluded them from it. So it was focusing solely on cis women. So you excluded
and
the
black
people.
Women really, yes, got fucked over by the women's movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you're isolating or pushing out people who have been with you from the start, it's like, yeah, you're getting possibly, you're making the strides that you want to make, but you're doing so at the cost of the people who have been fighting alongside you throughout that.
Yeah, I mean, I think respectability politics is a sham, but that's another podcast. But the point that I wanted to make, the reason I bring up Pride, not only because I love having that argument every Pride, it's my favorite thing. I've written about it at least three times now. But also, there that creates an interesting dynamic of, like, whose consent matters. Like, and when it comes to something like a public event, how do you navigate consent? Now, my opinion is, you know, like, there's a history of prides. You know what that's going to look like. If you are going there, if you are voluntarily entering that space with yourself or your children, then you are consenting on some level to being around, you know, a history that includes drag queens, that includes leather people. I don't want to define what is appropriate by whatever Republican white men think is appropriate for people to do in the streets or off of them. So I'm very reticent to allow people to redefine that according to their understanding of consent, you know. And I mean, I understand that that means that some people feel like, well, if I don't, like, it's unfair, I'm LGBTQ, I should be comfortable and safe at Pride, and you're saying that, well, maybe Pride's not for you. I don't think there's an easy solution. I do think that there is this desire to control other people to make ourselves feel better. That is what I see showing up in this, that I want, I mean, God, and I hate talking, like, there's a part of me that hates this conversation, in that it's like, I believe in safe spaces. Also, I don't think that they mean what everyone says that they mean anymore. You know, like I do agree that the world is not a safe space, and it shouldn't be made into one, because who gets to decide what that safe space is? Right now, we're seeing, especially in Florida, we're seeing Republican white men deciding what a safe space is for their children. And it doesn't include Black people, and it doesn't include trans people, and it doesn't include queer people. I'm not okay with that, you know? And I mean, I guess on some level, that's their consent. And, like, maybe I'm okay with, like, pushing their boundaries. You know, I don't know. I think, you know, I think that's a difficult discussion.
Yeah, I think one of the things I try to point out to people pretty often when I'm doing presentations or having these kind of harder conversations is that you can dictate what's okay for you, but you cannot dictate what is okay or what other people are going to do. As long as you are not hurting other people, it doesn't fucking matter what you do. But if you are doing things that are hurting people, you are making it so, if we're going to just use Florida as the example, it's like if you are making it so that somebody who is gay does not feel safe in that community now or in that state, you have now actively done something that is going to possibly harm someone else. You are making it so they they're making it so that they cannot willfully consent to going outside and having a just perfectly fine, normal day, because now they have to understand that there is going to be, on some level, things that are in place that could possibly bring them harm if they were to do things that they were just normally, regularly do in pretty much any other state.
Right. Well, and I mean, and I think that this sort of exposes another really complex, I mean, so much of this ends up being philosophy, like, and what is harm? And who gets to define what harm is, right? I mean, as far as, sorry, hold on. So I think that this brings up a really interesting discussion and idea and philosophy about what is harm, right? Like, because as far as these Republicans are concerned, they are alleviating harm as they see it. They are coming at this with the perspective that trans people existing in bathrooms causes harm. Now, they're not correct, but like, harm is one of those amorphous things, especially when it comes to psychological harm, that it's like there isn't really a definition. So how do you move forward from there, right? Like, I think it's so important to recognize, even with people that I would consider my enemies, I guess, like, that they are also coming from their perspective. And I think that their perspective is mm-hmm. ignorant, and I think that their perspective is misinformed. I also can recognize that they really, a lot of them at least, really do believe this. They really do believe that there was a child trafficking ring out of a pizza shop, you know, like they really believe that. And so they are coming from a place where they want to alleviate that harm that they think is happening. And I don't agree with them, but I understand them. You know, like, I understand that that's why they're so rabid about this. And I think that they are, by trying to avoid harm, they are causing harm. And I think that that is a tension that in certain areas is going to be very difficult to find a mutually acceptable response. I mean, mask wearing, I think, is another really good example of this. Like, my consent to do what I want to do might cause harm to other people based on my choice. Like, if I choose not to wear a mask at a grocery store, those workers don't get to consent or not consent to me doing that. That, I mean, that's their workplace. I guess they can revoke consent by getting a new job, you know, but like, you know, there's like all of these ways where that becomes really complicated. And like, it's, I think as much as I wish I could be like, here, read my workbook and you'll be able to solve all these problems, I think that it's also, it's helped me find a sense of serenity in the fact that there are no answers. And being stable in instability, if that makes sense. Like, being able to understand that the thing, like, my morals and ethics are not everyone's morals and ethics. And just as I don't want them to push theirs on me, I have to recognize that they feel I'm pushing mine on them. Now, I would like to see the most benefit to the most people and most categories of people. And I do think that sometimes these Republicans want what's best for white, straight, cis men, especially of the middle and upper classes. So I would like to pat myself on the back and be like, well, my thing is better, clearly. But, you know, I also, it helps me fight them better if I understand why they're doing the things that they're doing, if that makes sense. Like, it's not, it doesn't excuse any of it, but it allows me to be like, okay, here is what I do have control over. Here is where I can help. And here is where I am just going to be driving myself up a wall to no effect.
Yeah. Well, even so, bringing this really kind of more into the, bringing this towards the consent conversation, especially since I really, I want to be respectful of your time as well, Kitty, knowing that we're getting a bit towards the end here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Looking at that piece of trying to recognize and understand where they are coming from so you can help better combat them, but basically also helping understand like why they are invested in this, why are they putting this in, like what is their goal, what do they like out of this, what do they want out of it. If you're able to have that conversation with just like a dating partner, it helps you really fully understand what pieces of things do they have going on that they're consenting to and that might not be, or that they might not be consenting to. Conversations are the easiest way to understand what people are thinking and what they have going on inside their head. You're never going to be able to mind read someone. So basically, if you take anything from this, if you're listening, be willing to have the conversation, because if you are willing to have the conversation, it makes it easier for you to not have that moment later on where you're like, ooh, I did break that person's consent, or I crossed that boundary when I didn't mean to, because I didn't know. You don't know what you don't know, but once you do, you know you're not going to make that mistake and do it or hurt them.
Yeah, and I mean, and stay curious. You know, ask questions. Ask open-ended questions, you know, and like ask those same questions of yourself. Like in the example that you had given, and I know I went off on a wild tangent into like politics, okay, but I do think that these macro things come into these micro situations and vice versa. When it comes to like putting too much spice in food, I think if your partner understands, oh, he did it accidentally, like he got a phone call or something and he just didn't realize he already put it in there, that is, she's going to feel really differently about that than if you're like, I decided to challenge you. You know, and like, I think that those are very different intentions, and the way that you talk about it and the way that you resolve it is going to be different because those are two very, I mean, the thing that happened is the same, but why it happened is different. And not just why it happened for you, like why you did it, but also like the environment around how it happened. We don't always get to have that, you know? I mean, there are a lot of situations where our consent is violated and we don't really want to seek to understand why the other person did it. And, you know, we don't have to. It's not work that we always have to do. If you've been abused, if you've been sexually assaulted, it doesn't, knowing the other person's intentions is not helpful necessarily. It might be. I mean, some people, it is helpful to be like, oh, they took advantage of this situation, or, oh, they wanted to feel powerful. Like that can help people heal for some folks, but that's not for everybody. And it's also completely valid to be like, they're a dick and that's all I need to know. You know, like, I think it is wonderful when you can reach a state of under understanding and possibly forgiveness of somebody else crossing your boundaries. And it's also not going to happen every time. And that's okay too. You know, like, we're human and we don't have to be perfect. And it exhausts us to try to be, you know. But I think that, I think the thing that has helped me the most when it comes to these kinds of conversations, especially when it comes to conversations with somebody who has crossed a boundary, either directly or like indirectly when it comes to like how they vote, is aggressive good faith. Just saying to them, like, I'm sure when you did that, this was not the intention that you wanted, right? And that sort of pointed right, it does a lot of work there, right? Because it's like, you're asking them for confirmation. You are saying, I am willing to give you the benefit of the doubt here. But I also, like, I'm making it really clear what you've done. So is that really what you want to have done here? And I find that a lot of times, not every time, but a lot of times people do back down when you give them that, that ability to kind of back off. If you give them the stern look, they'll generally be like, oh yeah, okay, no, I was crossing something there. And again, not every time, but I've been really amazed at my ability by using that aggressive good faith in people that they don't want to hurt other people and that they do have, to them, good reasons for what they've done. I've been able to have really productive conversations with people who have crossed, violated someone's consent, who have voted for Trump, you know, like, who have said that, you know, we should all be more civil to Nazis in our country, and just talk to them and they'll be better. You know, like, I've been surprised at how that aggressive good faith has enabled people to let their guard down a little bit and be like, well, okay, I see what you're saying. All right, I guess if I'm not being defensive, they don't feel the need to be defensive. Right. And I think that that serves us when it comes to individual consent violations. If that trust is there, like if you are safe to do that and acknowledging that you might not feel safe and that that's okay too. You know, you don't owe anybody anything. But sometimes it will help you feel better about the world and the people in it if you are able to be in a place of safety and able to say, okay, people are doing this out of ignorance and fear, not out of maliciousness necessarily.
Yeah.
While also acknowledging that sometimes people are just malicious little shits.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, people just suck.
Yeah, sometimes people just suck, you know, like, and what I think means somebody, I mean, there's definitely a lot of people out there who think I suck real bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just got to decide every day, are you okay with that?
Well, Kitty, I have genuinely enjoyed having you back and having had this conversation with us again. Before we sign off here, and I know I had you asked you last time, but do you have any socials you want to push out to the audience in case this is the first time that they're hearing from you?
Yeah. So I think I said last time, and I'll say it again. I got kicked off of Twitter for impersonating libs of TikTok at no regrets. but I am on TikTok as at Kitty Stryker. I am on Facebook on officially Kitty Stryker, and I'm on Instagram Kitty_Stryker. You can also check out my website, kittystryker.com, or you could check out the consent culture focused website, consentculture.com.
Awesome. And I'll make sure all of those are in the show notes for our listeners to make sure that they can find your stuff. I'll also post a link in the show notes as well for your book in case anybody wants to check that out from her.
Yes. The workbook is 28 prompts that will help you think about consent on an individual, an interpersonal, intrapersonal, community-focused way. There's definitely some threads about politics and power dynamics and how these things influence these conversations. I did have a libertarian friend read through it and make sure that it wasn't too much of a frothing leftist anarchist diatribe. Though, I mean, I am that. So, you know, there's got a little bit of that in there. But it managed to appeal to my second wave feminist mother and my libertarian best friend. So I feel it'll probably be resonant for you.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us today, Kitty. And thank you all for listening. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Touchy Subs Pod to keep up to date when we have new episodes and other content going out. Please email us any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com. And please rate and follow us on your favorite podcast listening app. It really does help the show out.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.